Hi, everyone. Welcome to Flock Talk. I'm Aaron Morgan.
And I'm Jordan Sloggett.
And we work for the farmer members of the Ontario Sheep Farmers Organization.
This week, we are discussing the nutritional value of alternative meat plant-based food options compared to traditional meat with Professor Michael Rogers from the University of Guelph's Food Science Department.
Welcome, Michael. Thanks for joining us on Flock Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Michael, can you start things off? Just tell us a little about yourself and your career and what attracted you to food science and how did you get to where you are at right now with the University of Guelph?
Yeah, so I started my undergrad at Guelph doing my undergrad degree in food science. I actually didn't start in food science. I started in biochemistry. I really wasn't interested in food really at the beginning, but as I was at Guelph, I realized how important agriculture is and how removed it is from the general population. We really don't understand anymore where our foods come from. And that initially got me into the program and got me excited. However, my interest in food science really took a turn once I started having kids and once they entered school and seeing how much healthy lunches cost to prepare and realized how expensive whole foods are becoming. And that's really kind of the evolution of how I got into foods, but really it was having kids and seeing, making sure that they have adequate nutrition and just kind of seeing the ramifications of that.
Wow, that's really interesting. I will also admit that I started out at the University of Guelph in the agriculture, but food science, man, that's a cool program. And yeah, if I had learned about it earlier, I think I would have gone that direction too.
It's a really great program because there's so many different avenues you can go into, from product development to safety, all the way through regulatory and sales. So it's like a real spectrum of an industry that you can get so much different kind of hands-on experience.
Yeah, I wish it was promoted more. Yeah, but Michael, can you tell us a little bit about your recent research comparing the nutritional value of plant-based burgers to traditional beef burgers?
Sure. So part of my research involves using simulated digestion equipment. And one of the nice things about that is it gives an identical environment to compare how foods are actually digested. So when we think of a whole food, there are certain biological structures within that food that kind of impede digestive enzymes. So digestion can actually change depending of the matrix that food's in. And because of that, I got interested in looking at processed or formulated foods that aim to mimic whole foods. So some really obvious examples are the kind of plant-based Beyond Burgers and the traditional beef burgers. But there's a lot of other little differences, things like Pringles potato chips versus Lay's, like fried potato chips, or breast milk versus infant formula. So all of these different kind of formulated foods that we've tried to mimic whole food structures, we've really tried to focus on more the organoleptic or the sensory properties, the consumer's perception. Do they enjoy it? Do they like it? Will they rebuy it? I don't think there's been as much thought into, are they nutritionally equivalent? And is the term burger or milk, should that be to its original whole food source, right? So when we looked at plant-based burgers, there's a couple obvious differences between a plant-based burger and a traditional beef burger. First one's the macronutrient composition, right? So when you look at a plant-based burger, there's a lot of starch, a lot of carbohydrates. In meat, there isn't any. So you're switching a lot of protein and fat for protein, fat, and carbohydrate. So there's one fundamental difference that between the two foods. But the other thing is too, that the structure of that food and how it entrains or entraps the lipids or the fats changes how our digestive enzymes can actually access those lipids, digest them, break them down, that allow them to be assimilated and taken up. So we were really interested looking at beyond composition, right? So not just what is in the food, but more holistic, and how does that whole food digest compared to something that's trying to mimic it?
That's very cool. Michael, you had just sort of referenced some equipment that you have in your lab that can simulate digestion.
Yeah.
That sounds really awesome. Can you kind of tell us about how that works and what that looks like?
Sure. So the University of Guelph is really unique in that we had two different systems made by two different companies that emulate different aspects of the gastrointestinal tract. I'm in charge of what we call the TIM-1, which is from a Dutch company. So the first T is a very long Dutch word, but it's basically a upper GI simulated gastrointestinal tract that simulates absolutely everything from peristalsis to gastric emptying to transit time to enzyme secretion, pH control, acidification in the stomach, a regulation of pH in the intestinal segments. And what that does is it allows us to look at how that food travels through the luminal phase of our intestines. So not really how they're absorbing, because that's at the intestinal epithelial, but more how do they actually break down in the fluids in our stomachs, because that's the precursor to how we absorb them. So the first system, the TIM-1, simulates the upper GI. The second part, or the second system, is run by Dr. Gisela Point, and that is the Twin Shine. And that simulates the colon. So what's really neat about that is we take a human fecal sample and we split it into two parallel simulated colons. And then we can actually put foods through there and see how the gut microbiome changes with regard to one food versus the other. So when we did that with the Beyond Burger versus the hamburger, we saw a very distinct shift in the gut microbiota that was present after 1 week of feeding these Beyond Burgers. Now, most consumers won't eat a full week's worth of burgers. However, when you think about our diet is made up of about 48% of the calories come from ultra-processed foods or formulated foods. And we've got to start to understand how we can better formulate them so that they digest in a slower way, much like we hear of the glycemic index of foods, right? So if you're a type 2 diabetic, you want to have low glycemic foods or foods that digest very slowly. Conversely, ultra-processed foods digest very fast, so they have a higher glycemic response. And we can look at this too for lipids. We call it the lipemic response. And actually structuring those foods in different networks changes how those macronutrients digest and are absorbed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I'm going to see if I understand this. So you have basically a fake stomach that simulates what happens when you eat different foods. And so can you tell us a little bit more about eating the ultra processed food versus eating the whole food? What have you seen in that? Did you call it a TIM-1?
Yeah.
What have you seen in that TIM-1? How do they differ?
Sure.
And what are you looking for? Are you looking for like energy output, or like how do you measure the differences?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, there was a lot of interest in why diseases around metabolic syndrome and health were becoming so prevalent. Type 2 diabetes is one of the conditions, obesity. And a group of researchers decided to classify foods. So when you talk about the NOVA system, it doesn't stand for anything. It's just capital N-O-V-A. It looks at the degree of processing that food has undergone. So whole foods are group one foods. Those are things like apples, bananas, meat. Group two foods are processed culinary ingredients. So that would be something like ketchup or mayo. Group three foods are processed food. So that could be a jar of pickles would be a good example of a group three food. Group four foods are what we call ultra processed foods. And what they're starting to find is irrespective of what ultra processed foods people are consuming, if you have a high caloric intake of class four ultra processed foods, you have higher risks of disease, of metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes. So what we were trying to understand in our experiments is how much difference in structure is actually enough to change the rate foods digest. So if you think about Pringles are all uniform shape, size, color, right? That's a formulated food. That's made from ingredients extracted from whole foods that are then formulated and processed into what looks like a potato chip. So that would be a group four food. Now, if we take a regular fried potato chip that undergoes slicing and is fried, that is a group three food. It's a little bit different than the ultra-processed Pringle because it's made with ingredients, whereas the potato chip still has a lot of its structure left that was in the potato. So when we look at ultra-processed formulated foods, these foods that we create structures that aren't endogenous in that whole foods, it actually makes them much more easily to digest. So even though we call it a plant-based burger, it digests more like a confectionery or a candy product than it does like meat. And it's because it doesn't have those innate barriers that slow down digestion that we have evolved for all of human history. Think of the foods we've consumed early on when we were hunting, gathering, or foraging. We didn't have a high level of processing. What's interesting is in our population, when you look at the control of fire for cooking, that happened about 100,000 years earlier in the Northern Hemisphere as a requisite for life and survival through the ice ages. And part of that was in the Northern Hemisphere, they started cooking their foods a lot sooner than in the Southern Hemisphere. And that's actually changed the amount of dentation in our teeth over generations. And so when we see how food structure has a role in our health, it becomes very difficult to try to look beyond composition and start to think about how do those molecules organized into foods change how they digest.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's incredibly fascinating. I think it's a good reminder that digestion and nutrition is a lot more complicated than calories in, calories out. Michael, what are some other common misconceptions about the health benefits of plant-based meat alternatives that your research addresses?
Well, I think it's any plant-based product, right? So if you eat a plant, like celery, carrots, wheat, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's good for you. Problem is, those foods are all very, very perishable, right? So when you look at Canada, when we harvest our corn, if all of our farmers were to harvest the corn and we didn't have an ultra-processed food industry, think about how much of that corn would spoil, right? So we can extract corn starch, corn oil, corn flour. We can modify it to form glucose corn syrup. We can produce high fructose corn syrup. So just because something's made or extracted from plants and put into foods doesn't necessarily translate the health benefits from that whole food to the ultra-processed food that has ingredients that are derived from that food. They're just completely different. And our body see them differently beyond composition. So it's less about how much fat's there, but more how is that fat entrained into that network and how is it impeded or protected from our digestive enzymes upon consumption.
So if you were going to give advice to people on sort of the foods that they should choose in order to have a healthier diet, what would you suggest?
Shop the outside of the grocery store. The produce, back dairy wall, and frozen foods. Everything in that middle, all of those canned and boxed foods, they're all ultra processed. They're all formulated foods, high in sugar, high in salt, long shelf life, very, very cost stable. Now you go to the outsides, you go ahead and look at a head of broccoli. The cost of that head of broccoli varies greatly throughout the year, right? Now, when you start to think about families that are in financial constraints, let's say a single income parent with a child with no car, how are they going to provide food for that child, right? So first you got to think of cost, but then you've got to think about where those resources are allocated. A lot of times in these lower income areas are considered food swamps where a whole bunch of ultra processed food retailers exist. So fast food restaurants, convenience stores, but there's very little access to whole foods, and the access to whole foods there are very expensive. So again, a single parent with child comes home at 5 o'clock from a hard day's work. Are they going to choose a $6 Happy Meal or a $6 head of broccoli to feed that child? So there is actually a financial consideration that makes ultra processed foods the more viable choice for so many Canadians. And we're actually creating a two-tier food system where only the wealthy can afford to eat whole foods through the year. So if you really want to stay healthy, if you can recognize it from how it's been grown, so it looks like a plant, it's probably pretty healthy. If it's in a package that has a shelf life for a year, it's ultra processed, and too much of that can be bad for us.
Mm. That's really interesting. I'd heard the term food desert before, but never food swamp. So that's a new one. Michael, so what's the future of your research and research into digestibility of certain foods? And what are we hoping to learn?
Reality is ultra processed foods are extremely important, right? So we can say how unhealthy they are and how bad they are. But again, with the perishable commodities we produce, we have to produce shelf-stable foods, right? So we need these boxes of cereal. We need these cans of fruit. We need all these different foods. What we need to do, though, is we need to acknowledge that the first generation of ultra-processed foods, we didn't design right. We designed them only organoleptically with the sensory and the palatability and consumer acceptance perspective. We now need to take a step back while keeping consumer perspective in play and in focus. We need to change how we design ultra-processed foods so that they become more like their whole foods. And the reason for this is that everywhere across the food industry, we are trying to valorize food waste. We want to get down to a zero food waste society. And to do that, we've got to take that waste and turn it into ingredients. Those ingredients can only be added to ultra-processed foods, not back to the whole food. So we're almost stuck in a downward spiral where there's no good ultra-processed alternatives that we can use those ingredients to formulate healthy ultra-processed foods. So that's kind of where my research is going. How does that next generation of ultra-processed food look? And can we make it digest more similarly to the whole food counterpart?
Wow. So what advice do you have for our sheep farmers who produce that first tier of product, that delicious Ontario lamb? What does the future look like for us in your scenario where people are leaning towards more processed foods? Where should we go as an organization in order to maybe elevate the value that our options provide?
I think it's about education, and it's educating the consumer about what the differences are between whole and processed foods, because that's really where your true value is. Comparing coconut milk to dairy milk, for example, they're two totally different things and they don't behave biologically in similar fashions. So anyone that's producing whole foods is providing value to the Canadian diet. We need as much of that as we can. And Canadians, we need to realize two things. Not all land is arable for crops to be grown on. And that's typically where animal rearing is. And that's an important delineation because we always talk about the land utilization, but that's not always a problematic situation because a lot of the places we raise animals, you could not farm wheat or barley or canola. So it has to remain an integral cog in the Canadian food system. The key is to keep that price fluctuation so that consumers can know what to expect when they're going to the grocery store next week and not to see these huge variations in price.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Helpful. Thank you very much, Michael.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate having you here.
I appreciated being here. Thanks for the opportunity to tell everyone what we do.
Amazing. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Join us next Wednesday for our research-based episode. Hey, Jordan, what's coming up on the Ontario Sheep Farmers calendar?
Join us for the Ultimate Ontario Sheep Convention and AGM on October 25th and 26th, 2024 at the Cambridge Hotel Conference Center. This year's theme is Unlocking Profit Potential, and we've got a new format. The AGM kicks off Friday afternoon, followed by a banquet that evening. The convention continues Saturday with keynote speaker Dr. Mark Ferguson from NextGen Agra, and we'll have two satellite locations this year in Eastern Ontario and Northern Ontario. Register by October 2nd for early bird pricing. Don't miss out. Visit ontariosheep.org/2024AGM to secure your spot. Today we want to highlight a partner we work with, Sheep Bites, a fantastic resource for Ontario sheep farmers. Sheepbites.ca is a web-based ration balancing program designed specifically for sheep producers. It allows you to easily create and manage feed rations tailored to your flock's nutritional needs, helping you optimize growth, health, and productivity. With Sheepbites, you can make informed decisions about your feed strategies, ensuring that your sheep get exactly what they need. Check it out at sheepbites.ca and see exactly how it can benefit your operation. That's sheepbites.ca. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe to your podcast app to receive alerts for future episodes, and please consider sharing this podcast with your friends.
For more Ontario Sheep Farmers content, follow us on social media at Ontario Sheep Farmers on Instagram and Facebook, at Ontario Sheep on X, and visit our website at ontariosheep.org.